This is a tape recording of an Al-Anon talk given by Maxine Noliger of Laguna Niguel, California. This talk was given at the Al-Anon spiritual meeting held at the 4th Annual Yosemite Summit Conference in the Curry Pavilion on Sunday morning, November the 22nd, 1987 at 9:30 a.m. Maxine Noliger is the Al-Anon spouse of Dr. Paul Noliger, whose story appears in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous as Dr. Alcoholic Addict, or is more familiarly referred to as page 449 on Acceptance. This tape was produced in the spirit of AA and Al-Anon's 12th step to carry this message, and members of both fellowships should bear in mind tradition number 11 regarding anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films in their use of this tape.
Pleasure to bring the most exciting portion of the program. I would like to introduce our guest, Maxine O. from Laguna Niguel, California.
Hi, my name is Max.
Hi, Max.
And I'm a happy member of Al-Anon. First of all, I want to thank the committee for asking Paul and I to come up here. It was a beautiful weekend. Also, I like to tell this, too, because Paul always says I give the perverted version of his story. And I would just like to tell you that I was the one that was sober. You can draw your own conclusions. On the program, it said that we were from Kenwood. I never heard of Kenwood. Somebody asked us if we'd moved again. We moved, I think, 5 times in 6 years. We did all our geographics in sobriety. And we've turned our will and our life over to the care of God, except when it comes to moving. And if God wants to move, he's going to have to move by himself, because I'm not moving anymore. Anyway, I wouldn't have come to Al-Anon 100 years because I didn't think our problem had anything to do with drinking. I thought Paul was crazy. But I couldn't tell anybody because he couldn't practice medicine. Anyway, so my solution was to try to find him a psychiatrist. And he wouldn't go, so I went. And I thought that if I went, I could maneuver him in going, but it didn't work, and I ended up going 3.5 years. I didn't learn anything about myself because I went to 4 different ones, and every one of them that I went to didn't talk. And I would go in and sit, and they weren't saying anything, and I wasn't saying anything, and I would think of all this money it was costing me. And somebody had to talk, so I talked. And I told them what Paul was doing and what my older daughter was doing, and each week I'd go back and give them a new story. And, you know, they didn't say anything, except the first one. Everything I said, he laughed. And I really didn't like him because I didn't think the things I was telling him were funny. Anyway, he had me tested when I went to him, and I took the Minnesota Multiphasic Test, which is about 600 questions, and I had the feeling I was being tricked, so I was very careful when I took that. And I also took the Rorschach test, but I had heard that that had something to do with sex, so I was particularly careful with that one, and I only saw animals. After we got on the program, I talked to some alcoholic woman and she had done the same thing. Anyway, when he gave me the results, he told me I was very rigid and would never change. And, you know, I was horrified because I was the only one doing anything about this mess. Paul wasn't doing anything. And here was this professional saying, you might as well give up. You know, nothing's going to change. Anyway, after I went to him for about 6 months, Paul decided I was such a mess, he was going to take me over to Westwood and have me hypnotized. Now, Paul had tried to hypnotize me one time. He had taken, about six courses in hypnosis in Las Vegas, and I used to go with him and sit in on the sessions, and they were kind of interesting, so I agreed, and he told me that I'd have to relax, so I laid down on the couch, and he gave me a Milltown, and I went to sleep. So he wouldn't do it anymore, but he thought this fellow could do it, and he took me over to Westwood, which is part of L.A., and at that time, the freeways weren't through, and it took forever to get over there. And we went over on Wednesday, which was our day off, because I worked in the office with Paul. And after six sessions, this fellow decided that maybe I should see somebody in Anaheim, because that's where we lived at the time. Another thing, he made a suggestion to me. He decided that maybe I should take a little Librium. And so I sent away, we used to get catalogs to get medicine, and I sent away and I got 1,000. The alcoholic talks about this feeling of impending doom. Well, I had that too. I knew something horrible was going to happen. I didn't know what or when, but I was going to be prepared. And I had those tranquilizers everywhere, I'll tell you. I had them in my purse, in the bedroom, in the bathroom, in the kitchen, every place in case I needed one in an emergency, I guess. Anyway, I didn't take all of those, though. I took them for a couple years, but they disappeared. I guess Paul took them. Did take anything. I went to 4 different ones, and I usually would go into Long Beach because it seemed to me that every time I started going to somebody, Paul starts sending his patients there. And I felt a little silly sitting in the psychiatrist's waiting room with Paul's patients coming in, and they knew who I was. So I would make my appointment very early in the morning and leave by a back door. The last one I went to, after I'd gone to him a while, decided that he wanted to see Paul. So I talked Paul into going, and he went in with me and stayed about 5 minutes and said, "I have nothing to say," and that was the end of that. A funny thing happened to us after we were on the program about, 5, 6 years. Dr. Persh, who was in charge of the Navy program, asked Paul to be on a panel. And it was a dinner meeting, and we just assumed it was something for the Navy, so I didn't go. And when Paul came home, he was all excited. They had talked to the Long Beach Medical Association. And he said that he noticed when he was talking that this one doctor was sitting on the edge of his seat, nodding and smiling, and he thought, gee, this guy must really be interested in alcoholism. And afterwards, this fellow came running up to Paul and said, "Do you remember me?" And Paul looked at his badge and said, "Were you at the VA hospital?" And he said, "No, I was one of your wife's psychiatrists." And that was the fellow that I had gotten Paul to go see. He was delighted to see him and acted like he knew all along what the problem was. But I don't think so, because after we got on the program, Paul sent letters and literature to all of my psychiatrists and told them that I was on Al-Anon and he was on AA, and if they'd like to talk to us, we'd be glad to talk to them. We never heard from any of them. I also went to priests, and I didn't go to the parish priest. I would go to somebody I didn't know. And I heard about this chaplain over St. Joseph's Hospital in Orange, so I called and made an appointment with him. And I didn't bother to tell Paul I was going, and when I went over, I was there for hours. And this priest said that in marriage counseling, usually he talked to the wife alone, and then he would talk to the husband alone, and then he would talk to the two of us together. So when I came home, Paul wanted to know where I'd been, and I told him, and I said, "He wants to see you." And so he very reluctantly agreed that he would go, and I immediately got on the phone and made the appointment for the next day. And he went over, and he was gone for a long time, too, and when he came home, he was furious. And I asked him if we were going to go see the priest together, and he said, "No, I'm not going back." And that was all he would tell me. Well, so I waited till the next day, and I called the priest, and I asked him what happened, and he said, "Your husband is the most stubborn man I've ever seen." And that was the whole explanation. After we got on the program, we found out that this priest was also an alcoholic, drinking at the time, So no wonder they didn't get along. I made a married couple's retreat, and I went alone. Nobody thought this was strange, you know. My husband was a doctor, and he couldn't get away. But really, I went to talk to the priest. And I talked to him for several hours, too, and he came to the same conclusion that I did. The Paul needed psychiatric care. But I don't know how to get him there. So, you know, that's the way we're living. We had absolutely no communication. Sometimes I would get the idea that we were never going to get anything settled unless we talked. So I would wait till about 11 o'clock at night. And by that time, Paul had a few pills and a few drinks, and that was my time to have the serious conversation. And it would always end up the same way. He'd be mad and I'd cry. And then I'd wait a few days and think, well, I didn't word that right. And I'd do it again and again and again. But by the time we got to the program, I really had given up trying to talk. Anyway, you know, it seemed like if I were in the bedroom, Paul would be in the living room or vice versa. We spent very little time together. And even though I worked in the office, I worked out at the front desk, and so I really didn't see Paul that much. If I had anything to say to him, I'd write a note and put it in the work area, and he'd answer me, and that's the way we communicated. But one Sunday morning, I was showing Paul some rust spots on the floor in our family room, and all of a sudden he was on the floor having a convulsion. Now, I'd never seen anybody have a convulsion, so I was terrified. And I called the doctor on the next block, and finally he got there, and by that time Paul had awakened, or whatever you do when you come out of a convulsion. And so Art decided that he should go in the hospital. So he called an ambulance, and I rode the ambulance with Paul. And when we got there, he refused to stay overnight unless I stayed too. So I slept in the next bed. And in the morning, he felt fine and came home. While we were there, a neurologist saw him. And he wanted Paul to come in the office the following Wednesday and have some lab tests. So since he had had this convulsion, he wasn't allowed to drive. So I had to drive him over there. And we went into this doctor's office, and Paul proceeded to tell him that the only problem was it was a marital problem. Now, I couldn't understand how I could cause him to have a convulsion. But if he said so, it had to be true. I believed everything he said. You know, I thought he was crazy, but if he said something, it was gospel truth. I've learned on Al-Anon that that ain't necessarily so. Anyway, he refused to have any of the tests, and we went back to living the way we had been. Several of the doctors in our building approached me about Paul's change of personality, and I agreed, but that's all I would say, because I thought, if I told them how we were living, Paul would kill me. So what I would do anytime anything happened, I'd call this neurologist. But, you know, he kind of threw me off, because he told me that Paul had a brain tumor, or early senility, or something else. And Paul told me he had a brain tumor. So I was focused in on that. And I knew he drank, but I drank too. I mean, Paul and I drank drink for years. In fact, he often says that we tried to outdrink one another, and he won by analogy. So, and I had been raised in a family. My parents died when I was very young, and I was raised by my grandmother and my one aunt. And when I lived with my grandmother, I had two uncles that lived there who were alcoholic, and I knew what their problem was. And when I lived with my aunt, my uncle had problems. But Paul did not fit the picture of what I thought an alcoholic was. I mean, you know, he didn't drink during the day, he drank at night, and after we got on the program, I found out he drank a lot after I went to bed, which... Paul always told me I was lazy, so I would stay up till 11 o'clock at night, and then I could go to bed. I just waited all day for 11. I used to feel, you know, we should spend time together, and spending time with Paul, oh, it was terrible. You know, we would watch television, and I never really have cared that much about television. But I would just get interested in something, and he would flip the channel. And, it would drive me crazy, you know, just watch. He still does that. So I don't watch much television with him. But anyway, like I say, we had no communication. And so he refused to have any of the tests, and we went back to living the way we had been. And then 14 months later, I was in the living room one Saturday night, and I heard this noise back in the bedroom. And I walked back, and there was Paul on the floor having a convulsion. So I sat down on the edge of the bed, and I watched him. And when he finished, I said, "You've got to go to bed. You just had a convulsion." And I hadn't even been down on yet. I was an old hand at it by that time. Anyway, after he had this convulsion, I called the neurologist the next morning and told him what happened, and I guess maybe he was kind of sick of hearing from me. And so he suggested that Paul go back to the Mayo Clinic, and it took a month to get in. And during that month, Paul was going, he wasn't going, he was going, he wasn't going. I didn't know until the very last minute whether he would go or not, but he did. And we went back to Rochester, Minnesota in the middle of December. In fact, it was the day that Walt Disney died. I'll always remember that. And it was a Friday, and Paul started through the clinic on Monday. And I really don't know why I did this, because I didn't realize what pills would do to you then. But somehow or other, I had a sixth sense that he shouldn't be taking the pills he was taking at night. I would hear him get up, and I didn't know what he was taking. I just assumed it was sleeping pills. But I made up my mind that I was going to get in, see that neurosurgeon, and tell him that Paul was taking pills. And Paul started through the clinic on Monday, and it took me till about Thursday till I got up enough courage to go over there. And I remember I walked into this huge waiting room. It was about as big as this room. And everybody in there was a patient, and if you were a patient, you had a number. Well, I wasn't a patient. I didn't have a number, and I don't know what I told that gal, but she let me in. And I told the neurosurgeon about the pills. And you know, that was so important to me that I do that. And after I did it, I put it out of my mind, and I didn't remember that for 6 years. And then after I remembered, I waited another year to tell Paul. Because he ended up in the nut ward, and I think he often wondered what happened. Anyway, it was the day before Christmas, and I went to see him, and he wanted out. And the only way he'd get out was for me to agree to take responsibility for him. And I didn't know whether I should do that or not, because I felt this was my last chance to get him medical help. But anyway, he told me that if I didn't, he'd never speak to me again. So what could I do? I didn't know what a good opportunity that was. Anyway, I agreed, and he said that he wouldn't drink anymore, and he wouldn't take any pills, and I don't know what all he promised me. So I agreed, and he signed out. And I'm a little hazy about when these things happen, but I think that we went back to California the next day. And we got on the plane and had a big fight over whether or not he'd drink the free booze. I won. He didn't drink, but he wouldn't talk or eat either all the way back to California. And when we got back, he bought himself a bottle and drank it all. But, you know, that was my fault. If I hadn't argued with him, he wouldn't have done that, right? Anyway, the next morning, I was frantic. I was up at 4 o'clock, and I was calling everybody I could think of. I called my brother-in-law back in Ohio, and he said, "Get him medical help." And finally, it was 9 o'clock, and I could call this neurologist and tell him what happened. And he asked me whether I thought Paul would see a local psychiatrist. And I said, well, I didn't know because it hadn't worked before. But anyway, when Paul got up, he agreed. And I think, again, I'm not sure about the time, but I think it was the next day. And we went over to see the psychiatrist. That was, I think, our first miracle, because in my searching for a psychiatrist, I had tried to get in to see this fellow. I knew him by reputation. I knew he had a good reputation. But I felt that the only day that I could go was Wednesday, which was our day off, and the girl just said, "We're not here Wednesday," and hung up, and I never had the courage to call back. But I'm glad that it worked out that way, because I think if I had been in there maneuvering, it wouldn't have worked out the way it did. Anyway, we found out later that this psychiatrist treats almost strictly alcoholics. I didn't know that, and I'm sure that if I had known, I certainly wouldn't have gone, because why would I go to somebody who treated alcoholics? Anyway, so he talked to Paul for 45 minutes, and he talked to me for about 10 minutes, and locked him up in the local nut ward. And I knew he was in the right place. And I could go see him for an hour every day. Now, Paul spent his time locked up in the nut ward, making lists of things for me to do to keep the world running while he was locked up in the nut ward. And you have to be pretty crazy to do that. But not nearly as crazy as me going back each day for my list like I did. And on the list one day was to go to the central office and pick up the big book. And I didn't know why he wanted the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was on the list, so I went. And again, I don't remember how long he was there before the psychiatrist had somebody from AA picking him up and taking him to AA meetings. And I didn't know why he was sending him to AA. And then one Saturday night, I went over to see Paul, and this fellow came in. And Paul introduced us, and Frank said, we're going to an AA meeting. Would you like to go along? Well, didn't have anything else to do, so I said, okay. And we got in the car with this guy, and I thought he was a real kook. He was telling us all kinds of personal things. You don't talk to strangers like that. And he was talking about how he and his wife had broken up, and he was trying to get back together with her. So he gave her guitar lessons for Christmas, and then she ran off with a guitar teacher. I thought, my God, what have we gotten into? And he took us to Laguna Beach. It took us about a half hour to get down there, and Paul and I didn't say a word, and I think Frank talked all the way down. And he took us to the Canyon Club, and when we got in there, we got together and decided we weren't going with him anymore. And I remember walking in there and looking all around. I was so afraid we'd run into somebody we knew. And we didn't for a year, and I'm grateful for that because our anonymity was very important. Anyway, when the meeting started, they turned out all the lights and they just had candles. And a visiting group came in each Saturday, and I don't remember anything that was said, but there was a feeling in the room. And that's interesting to me, too, that I felt something, because I had turned off all my emotions long before we came to the program, and I didn't feel anything. I was just sort of numb, but I felt something in that room that night, and I wanted to come back. And I don't think that I went to too many AA meetings those 3 weeks that Paul was in the hospital. But I think, again, it was the next day that Frank had this Al-Anon gal call me, and I didn't like her at all. You know, she called me up a dozen times a day. And I didn't have time to talk on the phone to strangers about Al-Anon, but I did agree that I would go to a meeting with her. And she also took me to Laguna Beach. The meeting started at 12. I had to be at her house at 10 o'clock. I didn't get home till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I couldn't take all that time. You know, I worked, and Monday was a busy day at the office, and, you know, the office would just fall apart if I weren't there. And I didn't like women's clubs, and things were better. Paul was safe. He was in the hospital. But anyway, she kept calling me and telling me I shouldn't work for Paul. And, you know, I didn't realize that, but that was my security. I didn't get paid, but it was a job. And so after 3 meetings, I told her what she could do with her Al-Anon meetings, and I quit. But I continued to go to AA meetings because I identified with the alcoholic. I had never heard people express themselves the way they did there. And, you know, they talked about things. Like I said, I denied all my emotions. In fact, I could sum my story up in denial and stupidity. End it down. Anyway, I continued to go to AA. In fact, Paul would decide every once in a while, he'd pick an argument with me if I didn't act right, and he'd say, I'm not going to the meeting. And I would get dressed and go to Laguna by myself. And at that time, I was afraid to drive on the freeway, but I knew I felt better when I went than when I didn't go. So I would go by myself, and after this happened a couple of times, he decided it was no fun to sit home alone, so he came back with me. But anyway, then that was in January. And the following October, they had a Southern California convention in Anaheim. And we lived very close to the Anaheim Convention Center. And I went alone. And I don't know why I did that, because I usually didn't do things on my own. But I went over on Saturday afternoon, and there were four women talked. And I don't remember anything they said, but I guess I was impressed enough that I decided maybe Al-Anon did have something, and I would go back. But I didn't want to go to Laguna because I felt that was too far and took too much time. So I went to six weeks. I went to a meeting closer to home. And I guess I must have heard enough at that Laguna meeting to realize that what I was hearing was not Al-Anon. They were living in the problem instead of the answer. So I decided I would go back. I would make a commitment, and I would go back to Laguna no matter what was going on in the office. And I remember going, it was a large meeting, about 60, 70 people, and they had tables set up, and I would go in and try to find a table where they wouldn't notice me. And it seemed no matter where I sat, that was where they started. And, you know, it was like they were speaking a foreign language. I didn't know what they were talking about. Even in AA, they would talk about 502s. Well, we didn't know what a 502 was. Paul never had a 502. And then they talked about being 86, and we didn't know what that meant either. We found out a few years ago. We went down to San Diego Roundup, and they kicked us out just because we had two dogs and a cat. And then one alcoholic woman stood up there one time, and she said she always wanted to be a hooker. And I turned to Paul and said, what's a hooker? I was very sheltered. I've learned a whole new language here. Anyway, after I listened to those women talk at the convention, like I say, I decided I would go back. And then the three obstacles that you read today, I think was maybe one of the first things I heard. It said you did it in your own way, in your own time. And that gave me permission to not talk, because I thought, I don't know what these people are talking about, and I'm not going to open my mouth and show them how stupid I am. Anyway, so I would just say, my name is Maxine and I pass. And I did that for a year. And I'm glad I did that. I'm also grateful that the meeting I went to, there were at least a dozen women who had been on Al-Anon a long time. And I learned a lot from them. And I'm very grateful for that. I wrote a little letter of amends to this gal who took me to the meeting and thanked her for bringing me to Al-Anon. A short time after I went, she stopped going, and she hasn't been there since. Anyway, and I continued to go. Other of the first things I heard was that I wasn't responsible, and that was a big relief, because I felt responsible for everything, and I certainly felt responsible for my older daughter, who did a lot of crazy things, and I felt that if I were a good mother, she wouldn't act that way. And I remember talking to Elsa. Every time I saw Elsa, I would pin her down and talk. And she convinced me finally that she felt that every child was born with a certain set of characteristics, and it didn't matter what you did, they were going to do whatever it is they had to do. And finally I heard that. I'm very grateful for Al-Anon. When I first came, and I heard people talk about being grateful and happy and comfortable, I wanted to vomit. I couldn't imagine why anybody would be grateful that their husband was an alcoholic. But, you know, it takes time. Anyway, I've learned a lot of things. In fact, Al-Anon has helped me in areas that have nothing to do with alcoholism. It's helped me with my kids. And they've done things that I couldn't have handled if I hadn't had Al-Anon. As I said, the older daughter, she drove me crazy, you know. And Paul and I never agreed on how she should be handled. When she was 18, she left home, She was going to junior college. She had a little money and a part-time job. In 3 months, that was all gone. And by that time, we had had a little peace and serenity in the home. And the gal she was living with wanted her to move out. I guess she couldn't stand her either. And Paul and I and our other daughter had a little conference, and we decided we didn't want Ann home either, because it had been like she'd been hitting me on the head with a hammer, and she suddenly stopped, and it felt good. And so I found her a place to live down in L.A., where, and we paid her room and board. And she had to think about it a little while, but she had no other place to go, so she went down there, and these nuns made her get a job, which was something we couldn't do. We'd tell her to go look for a job, and she'd just ride around the car. Anyway, we went on vacation, and when we came back, we called down there, and the nun said, Ann moved out yesterday. And I think it was about 3 months that she was down there, and we wouldn't hear from her at all. I guess she was mad at us. She wrote us a letter and said something about she was going to do all these great things, and that she wasn't going to be money grubbing like some people she knew. Anyway, when the nun said she had moved out, he said, "Shall we try to find her?" And I said, "No, she'll probably contact us," which she did. And she and her boyfriend came, and they were driving a rented car, and she had run up a $140 motel bill, and she wanted us to give her the money. Now, before this, when I first started the Al-Anon, everything I did, Paul would say, "Don't give me that Al-Anon crap." And so he decided to come and see what was really going on there, and fell in love with Al-Anon. And he went a year and a half. And anyway, he had gone in this length of time. So when she wanted this money, he told her that he could only share his experience, strength, and hope with her. And he'd never had that problem. And she'd have to figure it out for herself. So this was Saturday, and Sunday we didn't hear from her. And Monday she called me at the office and she said, "Daddy doesn't understand. They're going to put me in jail." And I said, "Oh, well, okay, well, we'll see you around." And she said, "What in the hell's going on here?" Because always before, you know, I'd be on the ceiling. And that was the reaction she was used to. She wasn't used to this release with love. Anyway, she had to sign a note, and they kept her books and some of her clothes. And I really don't think we would have done Anne any favor at all if we had picked up that bill. Because she's done a lot of other crazy things. Because when she first left home, we gave her a little Sony TV that she hawked for $10. And then we gave her another one, and that disappeared. And then we got a new colored console, so we had the old colored console fixed up, and we gave it to them with a $500 TV set. And in a short time, that disappeared. Now, she didn't explain any of those, what happened to them, but we found out later that the colored one, that they needed a battery for their car, so they gave it to somebody for a battery. And then we went to see them another time, and there was the TV there. And she went into long detail about how that was a stolen TV that had been stolen from a motel down in San Diego, but they didn't steal it. And, you know, I sat there and she could have been the kid up the block. It wasn't necessary for me to straighten her out. And that's a big freedom, I'll tell you. Anyway, she married this fellow and was about 5 months pregnant, I think. And she kept telling me, "We're not going to keep the baby." And I'd had enough Al-Anon, I didn't get into that one either. And so when she had the baby, they didn't let us know. And on a busy afternoon, they walked into the office with the baby. And I was a little surprised. And when I asked her about it, she said, "Oh, she changed her mind." And that's the way Ann operated with me all the time. She loved to throw me off guard. Anyway, and then I've never heard anybody talk about this. A short time after they were married, they decided that they did not like organized religion. And so they and some of their friends were going to start their own church. And she called one day and wanted to know, she believed in baptism by immersion, and wanted to know if they could use our pool for the baptism. And I said, ask your father. And he let them come. I don't know who got dunked. I couldn't watch. But if I had that Al-Anon, no way would that have happened. No way. Anyway, they've done a lot of crazy things. In fact, a year and a half ago, her husband joined AA, so maybe that will explain some of the things. But Ann doesn't need Al-Anon, so she doesn't go. She knows the answers for everyone. But maybe someday she'll hurt bad enough that she'll do something about it. I don't know. I said earlier that I've used Al-Anon in areas that have nothing to do with alcoholism. I don't know, maybe about 10 years ago, I had to have some surgery, and I went into this Catholic hospital, and the night before the surgery, this pastoral nun came in and said, you're going to have surgery tomorrow, aren't you? And I said, yes. And she said, you're scared, aren't you? And I said, no. And she said, of course you are. And I just thought to myself, lady, you don't have a program. And I talked earlier about us moving a lot. We had lived in this one house in Anaheim for 21 years. And in 1979, we started to move. And we moved 5 times in 6 years. And in one of our last moves, I don't know, maybe it was 2 or 3 back, Paul decided he had a bad back and he couldn't help me move. So I was pushing all these big boxes around, and I noticed a film in front of my eye, but I thought, oh, well, go away, you know. Well, 6 weeks later, it was still there, and so I thought maybe I better have it checked. So I called this doctor's office, and the girl asked me how long I'd had it, and I said a month. So she set the appointment up for another month. I know what she was thinking, that it couldn't be that important if I'd let it go that long. Anyway, that night when Paul came home from the hospital, I asked him to check my eye with his ophthalmoscope, and he couldn't see anything. And I don't know why I did this, but I put my hand over my good eye, and I could only see him from the eyebrows up. So he immediately got on the phone and set the appointment up till the next day. And I saw the doctor about 5:30 at night, and he told me I had a detached retina. And since they didn't know when it had happened, he told me that I would either lose the sight in that eye or at least I would have double vision. And so by 9 o'clock that night, I was in the hospital with my eyes bandaged, and I laid there that night thinking, you know, I could be mad at Paul because he hadn't picked this up, because I had mentioned it to him several times and he didn't seem to think it was too important. But then doctors' families don't get very good medical care. And or I could be mad at myself because I'd had problems with that eye before. And then I thought, you know, what good would that do? It's not going to change anything. And I'm going to have to accept whatever happens. So I went down to surgery the next day, and the assistant surgeon was a fellow on AA that I knew. And I was very comfortable. And, you know, I lost a little sight in that eye, but I never did have double vision. And I have to believe that when you turn your will and your life over to God, except moving, things are going to turn out okay. In fact, that was my experience when I was new. I used to have to try all my methods first before I would turn it over. And when they didn't work, I'd think, I don't care what happens. And then something would happen that I hadn't even thought of. Another thing that happened when I first came into Al-Anon and they read the do's and don'ts, you know, don't pour out liquor and don't hide booze. I thought, I never did that. And one of the other words that I heard in the beginning was resentments. Well, I didn't have any resentments either, so I didn't have to worry about that one. And after a while, I remembered that every once in a while, Paul would decide that he was going to quit drinking. He'd get up in the morning and he'd say, I'm going to quit drinking. We're going to change all our friends. And I'd help him pour out the beer. And I just thought this was one of his kooky ideas because I liked beer. And I said, well, I'm not going to buy as much anymore. And by that night, he would say to me, why don't you go to the store and get me three cans of beer. And we'd argue a little bit, and I'd always end up going, and I feel a little silly about taking the three cans out of the six-pack. And on the way home, I'd think, well, when I get home, I'll have one. And when I got there, he didn't want me to have one. And I couldn't understand when I was good enough to go get it. I guess I could have bought four. That never occurred to me. But knowing what I know now, if I'd bought four, he would have wanted four. And then the other thing was that Paul treated another doctor in his family, and every Christmas, Charlie gave Paul a case of scotch. And Paul would drink a couple bottles. This doesn't make sense, but I didn't know. But who knows? You drink a couple bottles, and the rest I'd hide. And I would put them in my dresser drawers and up in the cupboard and any place I had room for them. And then periodically I'd go back and count them, and I couldn't remember how many I'd put there in the first place. And I remember one time I had an extra porch, and I took it down to the office because I had no place at home anymore. And we had an L-shaped desk with a cupboard under. We never used that cupboard. So I pushed this quart bottle of scotch in there, and it clinked up against another bottle. And I reached in and got an empty half pint of scotch. And I thought, those stupid cleaning people. Never occurred to me that Paul had left it there. But the dumbest part of all was I left my full quart. I don't have any trouble with the second step. Anyway, I really am grateful that Paul is an alcoholic so we could find this way of life. Thank you.